Wait, don't hit that fast forward button. Two quick things. Number one, we've pushed out a big update to the Android Central app. We've got some new branding. We've got some important bug fixes. And yes, we've got plenty more in the works. So go to androidcentralapp.com and download that today if you haven't already. And we're going to talk only about our Android history project in this podcast. This is sort of a special Thanksgiving week podcast for us. And we've been working long and hard on our History of Android project. Alex has been busting his tail for it. So we wanted to give it an entire show, which, as it turns out, still isn't enough. So please go to historyofandroid.com. You can follow along with us. We still have a few more weeks to go. We've got many weeks behind us already. So much good stuff there. That's historyofandroid.com. Now, enjoy the show. Hey there, everybody, and welcome to the Android Central Podcast. It is episode number 264 for, I don't know, pick a day. What day should we do it? Should we do it on Thanksgiving?
Sure.
Thursday, November 26th, 2015. Welcome to the show. I'm Phil Nickinson. We're doing things a little differently this week. We are actually recording ahead of the U.S. holiday, just because I like turkey. Well, I don't really like turkey that much, but I like to eat. I like to not podcast while I'm eating. I don't mind eating while I'm podcasting, but that's a different thing. So we are recording early. We are recording without video, and we are going to talk about sort of one specific thing this week. So if it's your first time joining us, things are a little different. We'll be back to our normal-ish selves here in a week or so. But this week we have Russell Holly.
Hello.
Wow, you are really loud. Don't be that loud.
Oh, all right.
Yeah. We got Jerry Hildenbrand.
Hello.
Don't be that quiet.
Hello.
We have Alex Dobie. Alex is kind of the man.
Normal volume.
You are the man of the hour for this thing because we are going to talk about our Android history project, which I'm trying to think, has it become a bigger thing than we expected, or because we actually kind of scaled it down a little bit?
A little bit, yeah. And I guess when we were first looking at doing this and thinking about all the craziness that we could do, and inevitably you kind of scale back from that into what you can realistically get away with and with the resources and time that you have. But I think we've done a reasonably good job with it. It's been interesting revisiting all this stuff, talking to a lot of interesting people, and kind of plotting the whole history and the whole story of Android from where when it first started out, where before it was even released in 2007, through all these ups and downs and devices and release cycles and stuff to where we are now. So it's been interesting.
We are what? We're on week six?
Six of eight, yeah. We are on the home stretch now, pretty much.
You say that. This has been one of the longest weeks we've done.
This is true, yeah. And there's more to write about as you get into the later days of Android, because inevitably Android has gone from being just this thing on phones, and maybe you have a few releases every year and a few flagships and whatever, to especially where we're getting to now, 2013-14, where Android is going into watches and tablets are still big, and you have way more devices and manufacturers coming in from China and other places. So there's just so much more to write about now, and that trend isn't going to disappear, right? We have Android probably becoming more prominent on laptops in the near future. We have, of course, even more wearables. Android Auto starting to get up there. So, it's not going to slow down.
Well, let's actually, before we start at the beginning, let's say Alex is doing a kick-ass job on this. So
I think I am. Yeah, that's a fair comment.
Humble, well, Alex Dobie. No, it's been fun for me to watch Alex basically run this and tell us what he needs. Let's start at the beginning then. And if you've skipped the pre-roll advertisement, which this week is just me, go to historyofandroid.com and you can follow along with us as we discuss it here on this podcast. And that's where you can obviously find all this as well. Just historyofandroid.com. We made a nice little URL for it. So we started with what we called the prehistory. And this actually, fun fact, predates me by a good bit in my use of Android. I was still on Windows Mobile back then. And I remember when Android was announced, I was still working at the newspaper, and I remember a couple people in there being really excited about it, and I was looking at it like, it's this weird Windows Mobile sort of looking OS with this HTC looking device. It looked very much like we had the Snap was a thing back then on Windows Mobile, and looked very much like that phone from HTC. I think it was on Sprint. Maybe somebody else had it too. So, I mean, Jerry, you were obviously paying attention to it back then. Mm-hmm. What do we call this pre-device thing?
You know, it's just a prototype like everybody else has always done in the history of the world when it comes to mobile. But because Android got so popular so quickly, it became interesting. I don't know what you call it. I think you call it good R&D. The guys behind it took their time and went through several different iterations and brought out a first-gen product that was usable and easy to build upon.
But
I don't know why you ask me, man.
But what we see now looks nothing like like that, you know, keyboarded. It's got like six, you know, it's got a dedicated, it has physical hardware buttons. I mean, this is what phones at the time looked like. This was pre-iPhone, right?
Back then, everybody, you know, LG and Samsung made all touchscreen phones before the iPhone came out, but everybody thought they sucked. The software wasn't in place to drive a full touch experience well. So, I mean, all phones looked like, you know, Motorola Windows mobile phones or BlackBerries back then.
And then the iPhone happened and basically everyone who wasn't Apple said, oh, crap.
Yeah, I mean, I think what Apple did there that was amazing, and you have to give them all the credit in the world, is they took an existing idea of let's make a phone that's all touch. But then they spent the time to make the interface and the operating system work with it. And that was the changing point.
And some of
they were also starting from scratch there, weren't they, as opposed to everyone else that had kind of an investment in their own platform. And if you look at what the original goal for that project was, it's kind of started out looking at more of a tablet kind of device and scaling back from there. And you end up with something that is very touch-centric from the ground up, as opposed to your Nokias of the world or Microsoft, whoever. You already have this interface that they're already building on that has, you know, thousands of devices already shipping.
And credit to the people at Google, they saw and they're like, oh crap, look how much more and better we can do with our final product down the road if we make this switch now.
And there was also a case of wanting to transition people onto, recognizing that was where things were going and wanting to transition people towards it. So not going all touch straight away. So like with the G1, it was of course different to the Sooner prototype that we all see in the first part of the history series. But if you talk to HTC and talk to Google about it, it's basically this kind of halfway house. So it's maybe as you're using it, you start to use the touchscreen more and the keyboard less, and it's like this nice sort of gateway device into a world of full touchscreen phones.
And some of that had to do with the technology we had available at the time. I mean, I remember back when Android didn't have multi-touch, and we used to have to, you know, differentiate, hey, this phone has it, this doesn't. I think Google Maps is one of the first apps to support pinch to zoom, you know, pinch and zoom and all that. And, I'm trying to think, resistive screens, moving away from capacitive. Or, I'm sorry, reverse that. I was up late last night. The move to capacitive screens instead of resistive screens, where you had to push hard enough for two, you know, physical layers of plastic basically to touch each other and make the connection, so your phone can tell where you were pressing. I mean, it was a big, big change, right?
Yep.
Yes.
Yeah. The G1 is. I have never been excited about a phone as much as I was with the G1.
I don't think you have been since.
No. And that's because it let me see what the future was going to be with the touch on the screen and how, oh, this is so cool. I remember the first game I installed on it that was all touch. I'm like, wow, this is really cool. But it also had a keyboard there and let me be productive without saying, oh, I wish I could still do this, because you could still do it. That phone was so far ahead of its time, and it doesn't get the credit it deserves.
And you got to remember that a lot of – you think about basic functionality – on Android, a lot of the basic functionality that we take for granted on Android and the iPhone now was in Android, but was not in the iPhone. So things like copy and paste came to Android much earlier. A lot of extensibility stuff like share intents was an Android thing long before iOS did it. So you start from different places, and it's easy to think that one got a lot of really core principles right from the beginning, but you're starting from different places, and it's a case of what features you have at the start, and eventually you move on a more common path.
Was I the only one who wasn't using Android from the beginning here?
No, I was using an iPhone 3G back then.
Really?
Yeah.
I actually waited in line for about 45 minutes to buy the G1 on launch day in Washington, D.C.
I came from, I was a server administrator and was obsessed with the OpenMoko handset.
What was that? Give me some background.
This was an attempt to make a completely open source device. Hardware, software, radios, they wanted it all to be 100% open source. It was this all touchscreen experience that I was just obsessed with for months. And HTC and Google announced the G1, and the OpenMoko project just bombed. Like, it fell off the face of the earth for a couple of reasons, not just the G1 announcement. And so I immediately went and got a G1 instead.
You were okay, though, right? Yeah.
Well, I think another thing, what the G1 did, and I'm not going to say this is a good thing because it's not completely a good thing. Right off the bat, Google had partners, you know, like HTC, say, you know, go ahead and build a little bit different version of this if you like. We don't mind.
Mm. Right. And that was a huge deal because the restrictions of the other platform holders at the time, you couldn't do anything like that. There was nowhere near the freedom you know, for app developers, not just for them, but for people who make the phones to tweak Android and differentiate in different ways. And as much as that does lead to fragmentation and it makes it more difficult to keep things up to date with platform updates and stuff, that is a huge reason why Android has been able to get as much market share as it has right now.
We've been focusing a lot on the devices and the OS in this series, but not quite so much on the applications at the time. I mean, what was it like in the beginning? How was it bad? Did you know it was bad, or was it just early and everybody kind of recognized that?
It was bad. but then again, everything was bad.
Sure, right.
What really pushed me over the top and made me, I know I'm going to use Android as my platform until something better comes along, is we didn't have app stores at first. Mm-hmm. We didn't have a lot of ways to get apps. But with the G1, Google gave you documentation. You could build your own. I remember my first little Hello World app, and I sideloaded it to my phone, and it worked. You can't do that with any other platform as easily as you could with Android. So I just, even back then, I knew, well, this is going to be big.
I'm trying to remember, with Windows Mobile, it was essentially you would download the applications on a computer, just mm-hmm. like as a normal EXE, and then run that. And then it would push it over to your phone, I think. And it was kind of a mess. And, I mean, I'll be honest, I didn't pay for a whole lot of apps back then. Because, I mean, and that was part of the problem. It was a big pain in the butt to do it, right?
Yep.
Make it easy and people will use it. I still think today, I was talking to, who was I giving a hard time? I was giving Renee a hard time because just with all the problems the Mac app stores had in the past couple of weeks, I was listening to Chris Lacey's podcast on the way in, and they're talking about Apple headaches in the latest one. And just, I don't think the Google Play Store gets enough credit for being as good as it is. Both on the front end and the back end for developers, which is actually a part that I get to mess with, even though I'm not a real developer. But it's so well done and so easily done. So that's if I think back, you know, really night and day for me, you know, coming from one platform to another. But just being able to install applications, like you said, is so easy.
I mean, it's easier to make a really good app for the iPhone or for a Windows phone. I'll come right out and say that the developer tools are better. There's still the learning curve. You have to know how to program. But what Microsoft and Apple gives you is just top-notch, first-class, like something you would expect to have to pay for. But Google's getting there. Android Studio, is as much as I hated it at first, it's making – I mean, that's going to be the biggest boon for Google Play ever when Android Studio gets polished enough where anybody can use it.
And it really sounds like they're getting pretty close, pretty close, but I can see them moving, you know, in that direction. Russell, what was your first Android device? When did you?
G1.
The G1 was? Okay.
Yeah, I went from the G1 and then I had a ton of networking issues, radio issues at my house. where T-Mobile just wasn't, you know, penetrating the house enough. I couldn't stay connected, but it was weird because everyone else in the house was, you know, doing the exact same thing with their phones and not having any problems. And so after like 6 months, I switched over to Motorola's first Android phone. And the radios were just infinitely better. And I got my first touch of things that were not Google's Android.
My G1 wouldn't work at home because I didn't have T-Mobile 3G. I could only use it at work.
We are old enough. We remember a time without 3G.
Yep.
Here in the States.
And when the G1 launched, you could only buy it in a very select few places because they only sold it where T-Mobile had a strong 3G presence.
And that was true even when I got into things. We'll leap forward a little bit in a minute. So, Alex, what was the first one you got?
So I almost bought a G1. I was looking at, I think it must have been mid-2009. I know we were kind of a little bit behind you guys in terms of the G1 launch. But, of course, T-Mobile is all just Deutsche Telekom everywhere. So, you know, the 3G coverage, I think, over here was better. So they were, of course, selling it in more places. And I very nearly went that way instead of the iPhone 3G way. I think in the end, I was just kind of distracted by, you know, the new and shiny stuff and went down the iPhone road instead. Just because Android was very, very basic at the time, I was already kind of on board with some of the Apple ecosystem. So that's the way I went there. But then I kind of got bored of that, really. And about a year later, you got to the iOS 4 update and things start running badly. And I was just kind of sick and bored of it at the time. So I went in with the HTC Desire in 2010.
That's almost. It's not. It's. Is that really into second generation? You think, or is that?
It's only second generation. Yeah. You had things like, you know, 720p camera, these AMOLED screens, you know, the metal construction, all this stuff that was kind of premium and a little bit more beyond the first gen, you know, bog standard basic Android phones that were really kind of rooted a little bit in the past.
So that was my first. My first phone was the Motorola Droid. I came on to AC full-time, not even full-time, I came on, I just started, right as the Droid was released, like maybe a couple weeks later. Then we did CES, and the Nexus One was announced, and so I very quickly went from a Droid, and it's funny to pick that thing up now, it feels like a weapon almost, it's just, it's so metal and blocky, and like you can hurt somebody with it, and went from that to the Nexus One, which is kind of the antithesis of that. It's round and still, I think, one of HTC's best designed phones. Would you guys disagree with that?
Multicolor trackball.
How awesome was that?
Do you need to say more?
How awesome was that? And then I remember, I was so new. I'd been writing part-time, but there was so much I didn't know. If you think I don't know much now, you know, check back then. You know, going to my first CES and my first Mobile World Congress and my first, like, any sort of events like these. And I'm sitting in there with Dieter Bohn. Everybody knows Dieter, but if you don't, he runs, you know, helps run The Verge now. And Dieter was our boss here. And we're sitting there in the HTC event, which was one of my first events. I had very few PR people I knew, but they were there. And we get the Desire, S?
No, it would have been the Legend.
So that Legend, yes. That was it. So I think we had two or three phones out of them then, and it just feels like it hasn't stopped since then.
And it was different back then because HTC was kind of all over the map in terms of, and actually everyone was back then.
Sure.
It wasn't just them. And nowadays everyone is kind of focused around one flagship brand, if you like. You've got the One Series, Galaxy S, LG, whatever. But back then you would get every phone would be a different brand, and HTC was kind of the example of that, right? You had Desire, Sensation, Legend, all these other names that would get thrown out randomly, and HTC was kind of the big brand behind that. But there was no real way of telling what was the high-end thing, what was the low-end thing. You would just kind of have a new HTC phone.
What was the it was one of Jerry's favorite phones too. I had a Fender version of it, not the Aeris.
The MyTouch 3G.
Yeah.
That was, man, that was so cool when it first came out.
Remember, now, it had those tiny little physical buttons.
But it just, my biggest thing was it was the first look at, this was long before custom launchers were in Google Play.
Yep.
But the HTC MyTouch had so many customization options built into it, and it was the first time anybody had ever done anything like that, and it was like, holy cow.
You can change everything. At that point I guess at that point, to get that kind of customization, you had to resort to cracking a phone open, hacking around with it.
Yes.
And that was where some of the popularity in the early days of Cyanogen Modern and ROMs like that came around.
Oh, man, it's fun thinking back. Yeah, and every now and then I go back and look at our old reviews, and it's just so awful. We were so bad.
We were growing up just like Android was.
Yeah, very much so, actually.
It's funny to look at some of the how the priorities change over the years as well. I mean, it wasn't too long ago that we would have a dedicated hackability section in phone reviews.
And it's just something that you don't need.
It's right. You needed one back then.
Yep.
I mean, my God, the Evo was a big turning point for Android. But if I didn't have a way to root it and make that thing work better, that would have been a horrible experience for me.
Yeah.
And it's because software updates were way less guaranteed than, in some cases, not at all guaranteed that you would ever get a major platform update back then. You look at some of the Sony devices that were available around then that would ship on 1.5 or 1.6 and just stay there forever.
Yeah, believe it or not, things used to be worse.
And that was from the very beginning, and part of the bad part about Google allowing manufacturers to change things. In Canada, the G1, what was it, the Dream or the Magic?
It's the Dream, I think.
The Dream. It never got Android 1.6 because they said it couldn't run it well. Even though every T-Mobile G1 got it, and as well as the unlocked Google version got it, the carriers in Canada just said it wouldn't run well and just didn't allow people to upgrade it, without rooting and hacking it in.
And that's just the kind that was the world that people operated in back then. It was the carriers that called the shots on these things, and they were still going from the feature phone days and the early smartphone days, where it was their product, not yours, and not the manufacturer's. So they had to say whether things got updated. They would go through things with a very fine tooth comb, and they would always have the final call, and it would be down to economics more than usability, more the user experience as to whether something got updated. And that's still kind of the case today, especially in the US, but I think it's slowly starting to move in the direction of sanity, where people realize that if you buy a phone, a 24-month contract, or in Canada on a 3-year contract,
it was insane.
And you expect some kind of post-release support, especially if the manufacturer is already doing the hard work and getting the software work done.
Forgive the expression, because it's not correct, but Russell, did you have to, quote, hack into your phone to make it usable back then, or were you able to use them as kind of stock and just deal with it?
I was big on doing things that adjusted the launcher, and I needed a hotspot for a lot of stuff for what I was doing back then. And that was stuff that had to be, kind of enabled through third-party stuff for a long time. So it was something that I did pretty routinely right up until, I guess, the Galaxy Nexus was when I started slowing down.
I
was kind of the same. I think when I first got the Desire, almost from the start, it was kind of a point of waiting for Android 2.2, because I got it summer of 2010. So by then, we were already hearing about Froyo, how all these amazing features are coming, and it was kind of a learning process for me that it wasn't just kind of like the Windows way of doing things, where it was just an OS that ran separately to all the other interface bits, and that you would have to wait for all this stuff to be certified. So the first kind of hackery that I did was basically, I think there was a hacked RUU that would let you put the Froyo update from the unbranded unlocked Desire onto a carrier locked one, and that's what I did. And it was kind of scary because you deal with Windows drivers, you deal with command lines and stuff, and at the end of it, it works, and you have kind of a neat sense of satisfaction of having bypassed the usual wait you would have to get, and you have cool new software on your phone. And it kind of took it from there.
I remember coming back from I think it might have been that first Mobile World Congress I did, and taking the plunge. I remember being sick and sitting around like, what am I going to do now? And I knew that Paul O'Brien at Motico, was a wizard with all this stuff, and had these, the early days of the toolkits, right? And had this kitchen where you could kind of make your own Nexus ROM a little bit, and and tweak things. And so I took the leap and did that. And that was my first custom ROM, I think, was from Paul, and who I have the pleasure of knowing, you know, a little bit now, and an awesome guy. And if you've never been to Motoko.com, you should absolutely check it out. Crazy how far we've come. I tell you what, let's take a quick break, and when we come back, let's talk Nexus, because we're obviously knee deep in Nexus now, but let's take a look back at the Nexus of old and see if we're in a better place now. What do you think?
Yay.
All right, hang on, we'll be right back. This special Android History Project episode of the Android Central Podcast was brought to you by Canary, a complete home security system in a single device. Since launching earlier this year, people across the world have been using Canary to stop burglaries and other serious incidents. Canary has a 1080p HD camera complete with a wide-angle lens, motion detection, and night vision, and you can watch your home live at any time. It's got algorithms that send you intelligent notifications when something out of the ordinary is happening at home. It has great emergency response. Canary has a 90-decibel siren that's loud enough to scare off intruders. Canary also pulls in local police and fire departments near your home, so if you're traveling, you can quickly get in touch with the right people. Canary automatically learns and disarms when you leave or come home. You can link up to 4 Canary devices together in a location, so it's easy to protect homes of all sizes. One feature I think you might definitely like about this is its privacy mode. If you don't want the camera on when you're there, privacy mode will turn the mic and camera off completely while you're at home. That's important. Believe me, you don't want it. Just trust me on that. So start protecting your home with Canary today for $199. Go to meetcanary.com and use the promo code Android to get free overnight shipping. That's meetcanary.com and use the promo code Android. Canary, smart home security for everyone. Breaks are a lot less uncomfortable when people aren't just staring at you.
Yeah.
All right, so Nexus. Nexus 1 was my first real phone. In fact, you know, we were talking about phones that didn't even have 3G. The original Nexus 1 was a 2G variant, I think. No, or was it Timo 3G? Is that it?
I think it's had a way advanced, didn't
it? Yeah, it was odd, because a couple months later, I think like in March, an AT&T 3G version came out. So I ended up buying that. And I hadn't had 3G all that long here in Pensacola. I still remember when I got it back when I had Windows Mobile, and it was like angels from heaven singing down upon me with data. It was wonderful. And then going back without it, and we kind of get to it in a second with some of the other Nexus devices, but I mean, we started with the Nexus 1, and it was this just different stock as Google intended thing that it actually sucked. Ended up getting new versions very quickly, right? It launched with 2.0?
With some caveats attached, but there was still the weird region stuff that didn't resolve until much later. But there was still a bit of carry involvement, especially outside of the US.
You should really move here.
And stock Android, whatever word you want to use for Android, the way it runs on a Nexus. It sucked back then, didn't it? If you look back at it now, grab your Nexus 1 and get online. You can still find original images you can flash and realize just how bad it was. And we thought it was great back then, but it was horrible.
I don't know. It had live wallpapers. I could touch it, and it would...
But I mean, it was the case that you needed carrier customizations to make things usable in a way that you kind of don't now.
Right.
This is something HTC was saying back in the day when they were getting into Sense and actually looking at, okay, not just how can we make it work, but how can we make it work in a way that is
doesn't suck.
Yeah, that doesn't suck. That is, you know, creates a positive user experience. That's not something that you were thinking about maybe in stock Android back then, just because Android and I guess Google in general at the time wasn't particularly design focused, so they were, you know, it was very much kind of like an engineer's first sort of platform, if you want to put it that way.
So Nexus 1 to the Nexus S, and I mean there were a couple interesting things about that, right? One, it was the first one from Samsung, but Jerry has been making a really good point in reminding us of this throughout, you know, really the past couple of weeks, right?
Well, I try.
What was it? But tell me what it was.
The Nexus S was almost fully open, as in the hardware was open and developers could look at how the drivers were built and what they did and add the functionality they needed, which made it very important for Google to move forward because that gave them hardware they could plan the next version of Android on.
You can actually still find people building for it today, right?
You can put a Marshmallow ROM on the Nexus S and everything works 100%. It's slow, but it works because they have the flexibility. Okay, our graphics card can't do this. All right, well, let's tune this a little bit in the kernel here, and we'll drop back a little bit on the animations and Android source code, build it, boom, it works.
It was a weird little, like, plasticky...
Oh, but I loved it.
Pebble, sort of.
And it was funny going back to that, I guess, after the sort of really premium cold metal feel of the Nexus One. It almost, I guess, felt like a bit of a step back in a few ways, even if it was technically superior to that phone.
Yes, I mean, I love the phone just because of the hackability factor. I mean, I'm on my fourth one. I've dropped one in the toilet, and I've broken others, and I took one apart and dismantled it and couldn't get it back together. But it's just, you can do anything you want with that phone, and that just had a huge appeal to me, which is what made me realize how important it could be to the people at Google, because they need to do things. I just do it because I'm bored and want something to break.
By this time, did we all move to using Nexuses? Because I didn't actually use the Nexus S very much. I'm not even sure I had one still, for a while.
I mean, I because the you get back to the hackability factor again, the Desire was basically a Nexus One with Sense, right? So it was really easy to port the Nexus software back to the Desire, and there were a bunch of ROMs on XDA. You could basically just flash it over really easily, and you turn your Desire into a Nexus One, and that's how I ran for a lot of early 2011, I guess.
And vice versa. And vice versa. There were people building the ROM from the Desire for the Nexus One.
Exactly, yeah.
That's right.
So that's how I was trying to get Gingerbread on the Desire, the original Desire. And that was a really cool way to get out ahead. And that was an update I don't think that ever came to that phone. So it was pretty neat to see.
Russell, were you running Nexus as long as you could? Or
so I used the Nexus One for quite a while, and then I moved over. I couldn't get behind the Nexus S. I just really didn't like the way that it felt. I didn't care for the way that it looked.
Yeah.
It wasn't really my thing. And then the Galaxy Nexus was on Verizon, which was the network that I had switched to by that point. So I was super excited. The whole family, we bought like four of them that year and just handed them out like they were candy. Because it was a Nexus on Verizon. I was super excited. And then we used that for a while. And then I did the same thing with the Nexus 4 where I just couldn't get behind it. I wasn't a big fan of how it felt or how the camera worked. I didn't really care for it. And then I don't think I've ever been quiet about my opinion on the Nexus 5. and then we've moved to this year where I am back on a Nexus. So it's definitely not been an always-on thing for me.
I was very much the same way. I didn't really use the Nexus S. I used the Galaxy Nexus for a while. Had a few of them, actually. And by the way, speaking of Verizon, Verizon was initially supposed to do the Nexus One, and Google flat out said, hey, it's coming to Verizon, and then it didn't.
Still have a screenshot of the web page.
Yep. Absolutely. So that was weird.
And they kind of transitioned that into the original Droid Incredible, which is kind of like a Desire with some weird Droid branding thrown in there because everything was a Droid back then.
Yeah,
and everyone had a Droid.
Nothing at all like the Nexus, which is how they poised it. You don't need a Nexus because you can get the Incredible. But it was still a really good phone.
Yeah, and even Google was pushing that message at the time, I think. They were saying, okay, you can't get the Nexus One on Verizon, but here's this other thing that is a little bit like it.
How silly does that sound now?
Yeah, I think for me, I was talking about phones that are kind of futuristic. I think the first phone that I picked up that's actually, well, I mean, a few, right? But the first one probably was the iPhone that I used the first time, the iPhone 3G. That was kind of a revelation in being the first proper smartphone that I used. And after that, I think it would have been the Galaxy Nexus. Because that, I think after using a few Android phones up to that point, was just so far ahead of everything else in terms of software and user experience that Android could offer at the time. The hardware, if you look at it in context of everything else that was available in late 2011, wasn't spectacular. It was a plastic Samsung phone, removable battery, all this other stuff. But it had a pretty good looking screen for the first for the time. It was one of the first 720p phones. And yeah, just Ice Cream Sandwich back then was miles ahead of everything else that that was based, you know, Gingerbread or whatever else.
Trying to think. Nexus 4, that was LG's first. And by the way, I mean, we're skipping around a lot here, but by the way, in the meantime, and we wrote a lot about this, Samsung just kind of took over the world with a lot of money and a lot of marketing.
I mean, they pretty on the marketing side, they pretty much brute forced it. But I think it's easy to overlook the effect of having working very closely with Google on two Nexuses and the effect that that had on their software, because it did improve a lot. If you think, you know, Samsung software has always been a bit of a crapshoot, but it was much worse pre-Nexus. If you look at the original Galaxy S, so it's been a case of improving on the technical side, and of course they've been they haven't been afraid to add a whole bunch of features, and especially in the GS3 and GS4 days. But you combine that with just a ton of marketing money, and that was what happened around 2012, where they had the Olympic partnership. They had a phone that was pretty good off the back of the Galaxy Nexus with the Galaxy S3, and they just kind of ran with it from there. And that was where you saw a lot of Samsung momentum going pretty much up to the GS5, which fell a bit flat.
The year of the G4, I think, was when the software really kind of started taking off, right? We got Ice Cream. What did it launch with? Did it launch with ICS?
G4. Jelly Bean.
Or, but yeah, I don't know my letters.
The S4, you mean?
The Nexus 4. What did it launch with?
Oh, the Nexus 4 was Ice Cream Sandwich.
Ice Cream Sandwich, yeah.
Nexus 4 was 4.2 Jelly Bean.
Oh, that's right. Because I forgot the Galaxy Nexus. I always try to forget the Galaxy Nexus.
You really didn't like that one, huh?
No. My problem started with they wouldn't sell it in the United States unless you were on a horrible network where I lived.
That's true.
So, and it's funny because we were doing some digging around in the run-up to running these history articles, and we always, you know, kind of knew that there was this not antagonistic, but kind of, there was a lot of conflict in terms of the culture of the companies with Verizon and Google and Samsung, right? So whatever deals eventually got a Nexus onto Verizon, I think from talking to people, it seems like eventually when the phone comes around to release, Verizon also has a bunch of droids they want to sell. And after making all these arrangements with Google and getting the phone onto store shelves, they basically tell everyone to ignore it. So it doesn't have any of the big marketing push that you would expect from a big carrier behind it. So you have a Nexus phone that is on one carrier, and that one carrier basically decides to bury it. Yeah, in the US, that means your only options for a Nexus are wait until the unlocked HSPA version arrives in like 3 or 4 months' time, or you got to pay $700-$800 to import one.
It cost me $799 to get mine through Expansys.
Yep.
For a Galaxy Nexus. That's ridiculous.
Not cheap. And even then, I think it still had weird radios.
Yep.
It was an odd time.
But on the plus side, when the first update came out, it ran so much better than the Verizon version, which had to wait 3.5 months.
Right.
That was another problem, and that's why I like to just forget that phone. Let's pretend like that phone was never built.
I like that phone.
I do Shut like up. That phone.
Shut up! You don't like the Nexus 4. Your opinion doesn't count.
I didn't like the Nexus 4. It was kind of neat to look at. I didn't like holding it. I don't dig the glass on both sides.
See, that's what I loved about it.
It was like a whole generation release before they figured out that they needed little rubber teats to keep it from hockey pucking across the table. Like, it was cute from a distance, but it was not my favorite.
Interesting little aside here. Alex had no issues with Carrier because he lives in Europe.
Well,
Russell had good service from Verizon, was a happy Verizon user. I can't get Verizon where I live. The two people that liked the phone had no problems buying it, and it worked on their network.
Yep.
I hated mine because I had problems buying it, and it didn't work well.
It's funny that the launch in Europe was still kind of a crapshoot because it was no one seemed to really know whether it was a Google launch or a Samsung launch. Stock was so limited at launch, and the one place that you could actually buy it in the UK, because I don't think Carphone Warehouse actually had any back then, was Phones For You, which has gone bankrupt now, basically. But back then, because they were the only place to get it at launch because supplies were so limited, they basically took the recommended retail price and on launch day and on launch day only cranked it up by £100.
Why?
Yeah. So they're gone now, which is good. But yeah, that was the example of the kind of shenanigans we had to deal with from retailers, even if it wasn't the carriers that got their claws into this thing.
Yeah, Nexus 4. And I tell you, actually, the other weird thing was that launch was supposed to be in the US, and then Steve Jobs died, and they postponed it.
That was the Galaxy Nexus.
Yeah. Nexus 4, was that delayed by the hurricane?
That was the hurricane. They actually canceled that.
In New York?
Yeah, and just did an online launch, I think.
Yeah, we had a couple weird things. I still love the Nexus 4. I think that was post Optimus G for LG. You had that cool crystal reflective process. We talked to Dr. Wu a little bit about that in the interview I did. I love that. I love the way it felt. The camera still kind of sucked. But that was a very different, slippery phone.
It was also the beginning of photospheres.
Yep.
Which was, I thought, the coolest part of that camera experience. The camera itself wasn't all that great, but the first time I saw a photosphere demo, it blew me away how cool that was. I did them
everywhere.
Yeah.
And there's still a really thriving community, you know, especially on Google+. You know, and you see some just incredible ones. I thought it was cheating a little bit when people started using, you know, professional DSLRs and stitching things together, but... yeah, some really cool stuff going on back then.
I know what I remember about Photospheres is I got a Nexus 10 and a Nexus 4 all in one package from Google when they first came out. The Nexus 10 did so much better on Photospheres because it required so much stronger hardware to do them correctly.
Right.
So here I am in the rain in a sheep field with a Nexus 10 tablet taking Photospheres, and my wife rolls down the window and says, "You're an idiot."
I did one in China a couple weeks ago for the first time in a long time. It'd been a while since I did any, and they still work pretty well. And they've definitely gotten better.
And Jerry was kind of touching on the Nexus 10 there. That's a Nexus that's kind of forgotten because it wasn't the sort of super popular, affordable Nexus tablet like the Nexus 7s were.
And you know what else? I think when they brought out the Nexus 7, boom, that changed everything because while there are a lot of people who like a big screen tablet, a 7-inch tablet just was so much easier to hold, handle, and use that it took a lot of people away from the Nexus 10, which was beautifully built, well-designed, but big and heavy.
It was also sort of abandoned a little bit, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Wasn't it supposed to get like it had that removable back and the magnetic things on it and...
That they never did anything with it. I know there was supposed to be like magnetic charging cables and all this other stuff that third parties made them, and they were, some of them were good, most of them were crap, but nothing official was ever built.
It was a little weird. I tell you what, let's take another quick break. When we come back, we'll wrap up Nexus and take a look at where we think things might be going. Man, I mean, we could have done like 2, 3, and 4 podcasts just on history and more. Maybe we should have. Maybe we'll do another one.
Lucky we have all this stuff written down so we can go and read it.
I know, right? So again, History of Android. HistoryofAndroid.com. I should really know what that website is. I made it. I made the URL. I typed it in. I'm a hacker. Anyway, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll finish up Nexus, finish up this installment of the Android History Project. Hang on 1 second. We'll be right back. Winter is coming, and you're going to need yourself a good pair of boots. For a long time, we've been forced to decide between clunky work boots or delicate fashion boots, or overbranded boots that fall apart after a couple of wears, or boots that are just way out of your price range. Well, the Thursday Boot Company exploded onto the scene last year with the perfect boots for work and play. They sent me a pair a couple weeks ago to try out, and that is absolutely the case. Remember, I'm in Florida. It's tough enough to get me to wear shoes, let alone boots. These are that comfortable. I work at a standing desk all day, and I have no problem leaving these on the entire time. Seriously, these are some good-looking, comfortable boots that don't break the bank or your ankles. They're durable, they're sophisticated, they're versatile. Thursday boots are handcrafted from some of the best leather. It's tier 1 grade A U.S. cattle. And for the cows that don't meet that specification, we still love you. You just can't be in these boots. They've got a Goodyear weld construction, glove leather interior lining, a cork bed insole that molds to your foot over time, and I love that. And they've got a low-profile studded rubber outsole for difficult terrain or slippery bar rooms. With prices starting at $149 and free shipping and returns, Thursday boots are a best buy this winter. Head on over to thursdayboots.com/android to see a selection of our favorites. Thursday boots, perfect for work and play. It's weird to change like one little thing and I don't know what I'm doing all of a sudden. Like I've never podcasted before.
You know what, Phil? You say this. You're hard on yourself. You are a hacker. And you know how I know this?
How do you know this?
Because I sat more than one night until 2 o'clock in the morning either on Hangouts or on the phone with you and a broken Evo 4G got to work. You are a hacker, good man.
Yeah, I follow instructions pretty well. I still say learn the basics of how images and all that stuff for Nexus work, because that will significantly change things. Right.
Yep. And it gives you experience when you do dumb things like flash the wrong radio on your Evo so you can fix it. And it's good stuff to know if you want to mess with these things.
So Nexus 5, our second one from LG.
It was nice. I think the Nexus 5 was probably the first Nexus that was actually a decent all-round phone for people who weren't phone nerds. It was a good Nexus for those people, but it was also a good phone for normal people. And you still see a lot of them around, especially in Europe, to this day.
Russell alluded to it before, but I think he needs to explain he has strong feelings.
I just, you know, what made the Nexus 5 popular was its price tag.
Yep.
And we need to not sugarcoat that. Like there was not a lot about this phone. The size was all right. It was the right size for the time. The rubber backing you either really loved or you couldn't stand. There really wasn't a middle ground there for most people in my experience. And the internal hardware was just kind of okay. It really wasn't exceptional. The camera was kind of terrible. The battery, especially in the early days, was kind of abysmal. The performance wasn't any better or worse than the other phones that were released at the time. Its big feature was its price tag, and that's not nothing. It had a really exceptional price tag, and it was easy to get a hold of compared to some of the other Nexus phones of the past. But it really just didn't feel like a decent phone to me. Samsung and LG were actively working on kind of pushing what a high-end phone could be at the time, and that was more important to me.
Yeah, well, I think I just never got into it because of the camera. That was a deal breaker for me.
I think the camera. I think people kind of undersell the camera. It depends how you use cameras, right? It was good at some things, it was bad at other things. If you had time to take your time and use HDR Plus mode, you get some great shots out of it. But if you wanted to just bring it up really quickly to use the normal shooting mode so you don't have to wait for multiple exposures, then yeah, there were absolutely better cameras out there. I don't think it was bad. I think people kind of undersell the Nexus 5 camera. Battery, fair enough. You know, there's a fair complaint of it. Sometimes the battery is too small, right? Internal hardware, I think, is for the time. I mean, it's a Snapdragon 800, which is a good chip that kind of pretty much holds its own to this day. Mm-hmm. There was nothing on performance that I think they could have done better. It was the top chip that was available at the time, and it was fast out of the box on 4.4 in a time where a lot of Android phones were still kind of laggy back then, even post Jelly Bean. So I liked it. The reason I couldn't use it as a daily driver was the battery. That was the deal breaker for me, which is a shame because I really liked everything else about that phone. But yeah, it was a decent Nexus, but again, we were still in this kind of phase with Nexus phones where it's like, oh, what are they going to screw up this year? It's going to be the camera, the battery, the display, whatever. And it's really only, I think, been this year that hasn't been the case, right?
We're kind of skipping over the software again, but I mean, at this point, they were rolling, right? And then we got material design coming into the works and just things were really working, right, on that front. And they ironed out a lot of the bugs that we had back in the days of the Nexus 4. I remember being in New York And I think the Nexus 4 was just becoming available. I was up there for some other launch. I think it might have been an HTC phone or Motorola or something. And people were just starting to be... I think it went on sale that day because I ended up having a Nexus 4 for a couple weeks before it went on sale. And we got a bunch of software updates in the interim that fixed some things or broke some. Yeah. I just remember a really weird time.
Yeah, because the review thing that you had didn't actually have some of the features like lock screen widgets.
Yes,
right.
A bunch of stuff that was missing, right?
I remember that because they sent me a review phone because you already had one. We had them send it to me. And yeah, all this stuff they announced wasn't there. And it came with updates before the consumer launch, which was weird.
There's a lot of weirdness. The Nexus 6, the original Nexus 6 from Motorola, too damn big.
And, yeah. You know, that's where I was at first, too. But I grew to love that phone. And I still, it's not the best Nexus. The 6P blows it away in most categories. But I think it's still my favorite Nexus.
I think, and again, it's not that it's that much bigger than the 6P is now. I think just the shape of it makes it feel bigger.
Yes,
and
yes, it's hard to handle.
We've talked about this before. Some designs scale, some don't. Yep. That's one that just doesn't.
I have big, strong hands. I'm not a big, tall guy.
He does.
Guy,
I can confirm this.
But and I can one hand the Nexus 6. I can do most everything with one hand on it. But it's not comfortable and it's not easy. I just still...
Yeah. I would use the Nexus 6, and inevitably in a week or so, I'd be back using a different phone. It was really nice at the time, but I say at the time, it was like a year ago. But it was a nice phone to use. Your material design was at home on there. It was speedy to perform, but it was just too big. I think if you look at it next to the Moto X Pure right now, that is the size that phone needed to be. I think anything above 5.7 for that design just makes it unworkable, and I think the kind of funny eggshell texture back you had to it didn't help either because it was just so slippery because you couldn't really grip onto the metal parts just because of the sheer size of the thing.
It didn't add enough to the conversation for me to justify that size and feel.
Well, it gets back to this thing of some Nexuses being there for developer reasons, for milestone reasons. Like you look at the Nexus 9, that was there because it was the first 64-bit Android device. You get to the Nexus 6 and it's more like it's one of these Nexus devices like the Nexus 7, the 2013 one, that is just kind of there so Google can sell you a device.
Now, see, I thought
there's nothing wrong with that, but
I thought the 2013 Nexus 7 was excellent.
It was excellent, but it wasn't, as a developer device, there was nothing it really did that you needed to be there for, right?
Right. I would still use one today, maybe. Maybe.
I know. What keeps me going back to the Nexus 6 is that Motorola DNA in there. If you live somewhere where there's a lot of spotty coverage on, you know, on the cell network you're on, you will learn to appreciate what Motorola can do in that department. And the Nexus 6 latches onto a signal quicker, holds onto it better, and just works better than any other phone I've ever used.
Fair enough. Go back to those two tablets for a second. I mean, the original Nexus 7, we didn't have anything really like that yet, did we? I mean, tablets at the time were still kind of a mess. Mm-hmm. I think Samsung started to clean it up a little bit, but you know, the very first attempts at Android tablets were pretty horrendous, just basically, you know, phone UI scaled up, and that was no good.
Pretty much. I mean, you had the original Galaxy Tab before Android was ready for tablets. That was essentially TouchWiz phone UI, like you say, scaled up onto a 7-inch tablet. And then you had the early days of Honeycomb with the Motorola Zoom, and that was their vision of what a proper Android tablet should be. Where
who's sighing, and why is it that bad?
Dude, you held one. That thing weighed like 36 pounds.
And look, it was almost going back to the old days where tablets, you know, a tablet was a laptop with the keyboard cut off.
Yeah,
it was that kind of feel to it. And even the Honeycomb UI was pushing more towards like a Windows style UI, with almost like a taskbar down below. And it took them a year to get around from that and say, okay, let's make it a little bit closer to the phone UI, and it's worked, and we've kind of taken things from there.
I hated Honeycomb, and I hated the devices it ran on. The Transformer I liked, but the first Samsung Tab and the Zoom.
The Zoom was huge.
Yeah. Well, and you had to send it away for 2 weeks to
yeah, get the network activated. Let's just go back to that. How insane is it that you ship a product, and then you ask people to return it for a whole 2 weeks to get radios swapped out. And that just, to me, speaks to how rushed the whole Honeycomb thing was, how rushed the Zoom launch was, and just the incoherence around Honeycomb in general.
Just Honeycomb, the only way it worked to my satisfaction was when you added a keyboard and made it into a little laptop like the Transformers. Yep. Then I could deal with it. Maybe a lot of that was what Asus did to the interface. I don't know. Maybe they deserve some credit. But
the only way Honeycomb works to my liking is as like a placemat to put you to.
To my own horn, it is the OS of which we do not speak.
Right. It's not even open source. It's just a mess.
It was such a weird time.
Current
generation. I mean, we've talked a whole lot about the current Nexus devices, but man, I like these phones.
And I think that's why we talk so much about them. They are so much. Did you expect anything this good from the new Nexus this year? I don't think any of us did.
It's, you know, as you get in this time of year, everybody gets all hyped and everybody expects everything to be the best just because. I've said it before, I've sat in too many rooms where I've been promised too many times that what I'm about to see is going to be so much better than last year, if not the best you've ever seen. These are not perfect devices, and the 5X for me is just too slow, and it's actually too small now. I think as much as I want to be somebody who needs a smaller phone, the 6P does a really good job.
So, Phil, you say the 5X is too slow, but I have a Nexus, I have an LG G4 here running Marshmallow on a higher screen resolution that works just fine.
Yep. It's odd.
Yeah.
There's some tweaks needed in the software for the 5X. I've used it enough to just see that's the fact.
6, 8, 10 months from now, it might be a totally different tune.
Yep. So it's more like a Nexus that we expect. It's nice and it works good enough, and you know that updates will make it amazing. The problem is the 6P was pretty stinking amazing out of the box, and we have to compare the two.
Yeah, it's, and my second opinion's going up today, or probably today.
By today, you mean yesterday.
Post it right now, Phil.
By today, I mean the day in which I am speaking, not the day in which you are listening to this podcast. I'm surprised that I'm perfectly okay with the size. I almost think I don't sound as excited about it as I am, but it's just a really good phone. I'm excited for the fingerprint stuff. I really want to see more app developers take advantage of it and get into that API. It's still kind of early yet, but the more we can do with that, the better. I think it'll be good for security. It'll be good for just any number of things. Russell, you're in the same boat here, right? You're all about the 6P now?
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of the 6P. The 5X, it's just not done yet. It might be a really great phone at some point in the future, but when I do things like pull out my camera and take a picture, and for some reason that picture never saves to the gallery, or, you know, these random slowdowns where, you know, button presses are often 3 and even 4 seconds behind, it's not done. There are some serious problems with the software, but the 6P, it just came out so good that it's really hard to find things that are wrong with it unless you just don't like big metal phones.
We've got all these other offshoots too. You've got Google Glass, which is sort of come and gone, but I mean, something in that realm will happen again. We've got this new push for VR, which I know Russell's very excited about. I'm actually kind of a little excited about it too. And normally it's not the sort of thing that would get me going.
I think you're so excited because you got in on the Vive.
Yeah.
The HTC Vive was like a full dive into VR, and because you never got really all that excited about cardboard stuff.
It's my problem cool, with cardboard is the implementation. Like sliding a phone into this piece of cardboard is just clunky to me. I think it's great for adaptability. You know, this $5 piece of cardboard that you can turn into VR is awesome. I'm not discounting that at all. It's just for actual usability, it's kind of like, okay.
Well, even the ViewMaster, like the ViewMaster gives it a more, you know, rigid plastic shell. It looks a lot nicer and you go to use it, but it's still there's still some actual issues with kind of getting sucked into what it is that you're doing.
I told you how my kid walked into a wall, right?
Yeah.
I did buy them a ViewMaster for Christmas, so it's sitting in a closet. I might have to buy a second one just to play with it now.
I had somebody from a company involved in, well, in the Tango project, I'll go that far, ask me last year, Jerry, do you think people would buy a version of cardboard that's not made of cardboard, but has its own CPU and operating system and access to certain apps in Google Play for $199? Mm-hmm. And ever since then, I've thought, you know, that's something that somebody should have made.
I mean, that's the thing that makes the Gear VR iterations that we've seen so far is that it's got that little bit of extra hardware for stability and stuff like that.
I'm waiting on mine. I ordered one.
We're probably going to be waiting forever just mm-hmm. because they don't actually exist, I'm convinced.
We've got Android Wear at the same time, and I still think it's a little... It was funny, when Android Wear came out, they were kind of hinting that, like, watches were just going to be the first use case for Android Wear, the platform. But we haven't really seen anything else yet, have we? I mean, we haven't seen anything else.
No, that's not to say that'll never happen. And you've got to imagine that if there's some new version of Glass being built from the ground up, that would be tied into it in some way. In the way that Glass kind of ran parallel to that before. It was kind of this weird thing. But yeah, it's just smartwatches right now, and it's, you know, it's Android Wear, not Android Watch, so they're leaving that avenue open.
We've got Android Auto, which I think it's going to become a bigger thing in the next couple of years as more cars have it built in. I get that people aren't really switching to it in droves.
But it's going to take time. That's just the nature of that industry, right?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. If you haven't read it, I forget if I mentioned it on here, but Chris Ziegler did a really good Q&A with somebody from, I think, GM about infotainment and why things like this take so long and how far into their products they would let a company like Google or Apple dive. You know, why you basically don't have a CarPlay infotainment unit or an Android Auto infotainment unit, and instead you're casting screens on them, and made a lot of sense. It was really smart stuff.
The situation with all that, I'm going to interject. You can yell at me later.
Sure.
My Jeep is breaking down. I've had it forever, and I'm in the market for a new car. And of course, because I'm a gadget nerd, I'm really looking at all the infotainment options that are out there. Right now is a horrible, sucky time for that. The car manufacturers all do their own thing. None of them really integrate, you know, other systems well. And I get the feeling that no matter what I buy a year from now, it's going to be just a dead product with no support. And there's going to be something else out there that I like better and wish I'd gotten instead.
That's part of why I'm glad I've got the aftermarket. So I can, yep. If it does come to that, just swap it out. Yeah. And we're seeing instances where I think there's compatibility issues. You know, we're seeing some VW cars that look like they might not be talking properly to the phones, and some of that's going to be fixable in software, but at the same time, it needs to work, because if it doesn't work, then why bother? Why are we here?
And this is another area where Apple nails it. The new Galaxy, or the new Nexuses have Bluetooth 4.2, which is hugely incompatible with a lot of car stereos. Mm-hmm. And that's just causing issues. Apple won't adopt 4.2 until all the other things are ready.
Sometimes it's good to be slow.
Yep.
I mean, there's so much we didn't talk about. So many other devices, so many other carriers, so many other OS versions.
Mm-hmm.
We missed anything?
I'm trying to think if there's any manufacturer we haven't really covered in detail. And I guess Motorola is probably one of the ones that's changed a lot over the years, right? There were, back in the early days, it was all about Droid. Now it's all about the Moto brand. And that's kind of the way they're leading things these days. And as much as they were sort of focused on Verizon, the US market, and the Droid side of things, now it's all about the Moto G. It's all about emerging markets. Yep. And for the Pure Edition is almost like fan service now in the grander scheme of things. The course of the Verizon deals is still important for them, but it really is the Moto G that is the big moneymaker for that company.
And by the way, and I get it, we're very Western, you know, centric. We're very US-based for obvious reasons, and in Europe, thanks to Alex and Richard. But we're starting to pay more attention to India, since we have a couple Indian guys on the team. My very brief time in China was a little eye-opening. It is a big, big world out there, not just for Android, but specifically for Android, but also for iOS. I was looking yesterday as we were updating our app, and I believe it's something like, let me look it up again. It's like 10,000, 11,000 unique devices that are supported. It's insane. I know I kind of say we should do like a weekly update. Here's how many devices we're. Let's see. C list. We support 9,225. All devices, 11,061. That's incredible. I'm trying to find one that that you've never heard of before. The Panasonic, FZB2.
I've heard of that. That's a Japanese. What's the big company in Japan?
Docomo.
Docomo. They build their own. Yeah, they build their own phones for their network. That's a Docomo phone.
The Pegatron P5W.
Now that sounds like a phone I need to try. The Pegatron.
The Positivo YPYL1050E.
Step back, Pegatron. Positivo.
I mean, by the way, there's South America there, which is a whole other ball of wax that I don't understand in the slightest.
Yes, and you should move me to Rio and we'll open up a South America desk. And
never hear from you again.
I'll find John McAfee down there.
This has been a fun, this Android History Project has been a really fun one for me because it's not just, we set out not wanting to do a Wikipedia article, basically. And really not just a narrative of here's what happened this time. We had this phone and this OS, but really getting some of the stories behind it. I think we've done a pretty good job, from Jason McKenzie to Dr. Wu to who else have we talked to? We talked to somebody else, didn't we? Steve Kondik.
Steve Kondik. We've got Jim Wicks coming up probably later this week from Motorola. Maybe a few surprises before the end of the series, so wait and see there.
A lot of good stuff going on. We might have to talk about this some more. I know we're not doing voicemails and emails in this podcast, but if you have any more questions about the Android History Project, shoot us a note, podcast@androidcentral.com, and we'll be happy to answer it in the next week or two. Anything else you guys want to discuss before we wrap this up? Again, it's a holiday week here in the U.S., so things are a little off. They're a little different. I can't podcast on Wednesdays. It's very odd. I feel out of it.
Everything is confusing.
I know. Nothing?
I mean, let's give just a couple of brief minutes about what we think is going to happen next.
Sure. I still think the car is super important. I really want to see them get that right. It drives me insane to see people pulling up next to me with a phone in their hand or turning the corner with a phone to their ear when it's so easy not to and so important not to. And especially as my kids are out riding bikes now and when they start driving, and I'm still not 100% okay with the way I behave when I'm driving, but I'm getting better about it. And Android Auto has been a big part of that. Plugging my phone in, and especially plugging it in with a cord that's not long. It's only 6 inches long, so I can't futz with it. I think that's super important, if not one of the most important things this space can do.
Yeah, I think the car is super important. I hope we see, Google actually push into the home. We heard a long time ago about Android at home, and it never really panned out. And now they own Nest, and now we're seeing stuff with Weave. I genuinely hope that the next year is all about, extending Android so that we get this context thing everywhere.
What do you think, Jerry?
I think the next big thing that needs to happen and probably will happen is the good $100 phone. There are 30% of the people in the United States that don't have a smartphone. The rest of the world, a lot of countries are wide open. And Android One is close to being a really good $100 phone. It's the right idea and a great first step. Motorola is close. You can buy $200, get you an Android phone that does everything you need it to do. Ignore the people that tell you that this brand is better because 2% faster. $200 will buy you a Moto G that does everything you need it to do. When we can get that to $100, look out. This world is, and I know you can go out, on Black Friday and you can buy a $30 phone, but you're going to hate it. When you can buy a $100 phone that does everything and ties in with the stuff in the home that Russell wants to see, the stuff in the car that you want to see. The $100 phone brings it all together to everyone.
And that's not to say we're not going to have better, higher-end phones, right?
Oh, sure. People like us still are going to spend way too much money on phones because they're so cool and we love them. But there are people out there who can't or won't. And those people deserve to have the same, I don't know, lifestyle? Is that the word I'm looking for? A smartphone changes your life. And there are people out there that can't afford to spend $500 on whatever we say is the best phone ever. But a $100 phone can give it to them.
I had the guys in India actually write up a primer for the Indian market. Here are the things that those of us outside looking in should know and need to know. And that was the big one for me, is that, you know, even 3G data is still really hard to come by there for a lot of people.
Yeah, a lot of the coverage is split up between different carriers in different regions, right?
Yep. You need two SIM cards. There's a lot of room to grow in that area. And I mean, it's not just Google who wants to capture all that. Apple wants to get the high end of it all, and they're going to help the infrastructure grow. And
so does Cyanogen, right? That's a big part of their strategy in emerging markets. And talking to Steve Kondik the other week, he's obviously, that's a big part of what they want to do. He was talking about internally them just taking some random $75 phone from China and seeing how much they could hack it open, tweak things, and get it to run really, really well, because that's something that's in his DNA as much as his company's DNA. So that's the one thing they're doing on their side, wanting to take this super cheap hardware, make it run Android really well, and also have decent software support down the line, so it's not just abandonware. So that's going to be interesting. And I think, again, on the high end, look, let's be honest, this year's been kind of weird for high-end Android phones for a lot of reasons, mainly related to a couple of the chips we've had this year that have been a little bit more power hungry than we would have hoped, which has been rough on battery life, and also means that engineering effort has had to go into tackling that, whereas it could have been used in other areas. But next year, we have these custom 64-bit chips from Qualcomm in the 820 and other chips. We have Samsung with its own 64-bit custom stuff as well. And this is something else Steve Kondik was saying. This next year is going to be where things get really awesome at the high end, because we're no longer sort of, you know, throwing eight mid-range 64-bit cores together and hoping to make a high-end chip out of it. You have these custom-designed chips that, you know, custom-designed cores in these chips that should give really good single-core performance.
It's going to be Kirin 950 from Huawei, which is limited to China right now, but still sounds.
Which you are never
going to
see anywhere else.
Yeah. What were you saying, Jerry?
It's going to be. Remember when we all had a Hero or a Motorola Droid or a Motorola Click. And then when the Snapdragon phones came out, the Nexus One, the HTC Incredible, and I forget what they called that overseas, the Evo 4G. Remember the huge leap in performance? And part of that was Froyo and the new runtime. But a big part of that was Qualcomm got serious and made a CPU that kicked butt. Next year's going to be the same way.
We saw that in the last part, I think I said that last part, part five of the history project. We looked at Crate, and as that was starting to get in the Snapdragon S4 era, and that really kicked it off for Qualcomm, because they had their own, at the time, 32-bit custom architecture that let them run rings around a lot of the ARM designs that were out there from other chip makers.
I have a feeling that the 820 is going to have that same type of customizations to the cores, and it's going to blow our minds.
And with that, I think it's a good place to stop it. We will absolutely talk some more history, maybe before the year is over. If you have yet to do so, historyofandroid.com. We've got all the weeks of content there. So much good stuff, interviews. You know, if you don't like reading, we have the video interviews as well. But seriously, read it. A lot of people worked really hard on this stuff, and it's really good.
It's long, but it's worth reading, guys. It's cool.
Take your time. It's not going anywhere.
Yep.
And it's free. No, I mean, because we don't charge for content. So historyofandroid.com. Thank you to Alex for basically spending the last 2 months of his life working on this. Occasionally we'll let him go out for air. And
I was thinking the other day, can you imagine what a mess it would be if you or I had been in charge of getting all this stuff together without Alex?
You want me to tell you the secret of running a website? It is acknowledging the fact that you will make it a mess and you can't do it, and hiring people who can. Absolutely.
Nobody but Alex could have done this because his organizational skills are like 5-star.
Yep. And in fact, I think he's about to send us another email telling us what's due for next week. So historyofandroid.com, go read that. We will be back next week with probably a more normal podcast and do it live and all that stuff. So Alex, Russell, Jerry, thank you guys. Everybody at home, historyofandroid.com, thank you for letting us do this and basically letting Alex take 2 months off to work on this. It's been really cool to see. It's turned out really well, I think. And we'll absolutely do more like it, I think. We'll let Alex catch a break first.
And maybe next year.
Alex is like, no! Any final words from you guys?
Happy holidays to the people in the States and everybody else. Stay safe.
That's right. All right, we'll see y'all next week.
See you later.
Goodbye.
That outstanding episode of the Android Central Podcast was brought to you by Canary. Start protecting your home with Canary today for just $199. Go to meetcanary.com and use the promo code Android to get free overnight shipping. That's meetcanary.com. Use the promo code Android. Canary, smart home security for everyone.